Boker Tov, everybody. If my count is correct, this is our 154th class on the Siddur, going on to, thank God, our fourth year already. And, of course, as we all know, we're in the middle of the Amidah. And we just started last week the bracha of Al HaTzadikim, which, of course, as we said, contrasts with the prior bracha, Vila Malshinim. Vila Malshinim is a blessing to, you know, all the heretics and the informers. They should be destroyed and wiped out, a very negative blessing, which we spoke about, of course, which was added much later, perhaps as much as 700 years after the original Shmon Esrei, because as we discussed a while back there, sort of the Shmon Esrei was composed or recomposed, you know, in two different stages. The first time by, we'll get there actually later today, hopefully some idea, by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the men of the Great Assembly, the beginning of the Second Temple period. We're talking 6th century BCE. And then Rabban Gamliel, it seems either they reestablished it, they've been forgotten, but that's the 18 blessings for sure. The 19th blessing of Vila Mashinim was only added during that time by Shmuel HaKatan. We spoke about why he had to do it. He said, don't be happy when your enemies fall. Only such a person can compose a prayer. Only somebody who cares for the enemy can compose a prayer against the enemy. It's such a beautiful idea, right? You have to fight. And this, obviously, the modern applications are many, but, you know, only one who has deep concern for everyone can come and attack the people that they have to attack if need be, so they won't go overboard. But that was done, they were talking now in the second century, so we're talking hundreds of years apart. Anyway, let's, that was Vila Malshinim. Now we're talking about Al HaTzadikim. So we mentioned last week, basically, the six people, we just got started on that, who were praying for a tzaddik, a chassid, ziknei amcha, the elders of the people, plektas sofreim, the remnants of the scribes, geirei hatzedek, the righteous converts, and us. So we're going to go through those now a little bit, one by one, hopefully, and hopefully add a little bit of insight. Okay. So we last week we just got to the Rambam's definition of a tzaddik. It's not the way we think of it, but it's a fascinating definition. The Rambam in Hilchot Teshuvah writes that a tzaddik is 50% plus one. Meaning you're a little bit better than average, or better than 50-50, then you're a tzaddik. Of course, we don't know the calculation. One mitzvah can be worth many aveirot, because, you know, and as I don't think I mentioned it last week, or maybe I did, the Mesher Chachma, right, that historical idea, that mitzvah can take on greater historical importance depending on when you live and where you live. So the calculation, we don't know, but the idea is that if you're 51% or 50% plus one and more mitzvot, then you're a tzaddik. Of course, that means the opposite is true. If you're 50% plus one, or maybe say it's minus one, and on the negative side, so you become a rasha. But that's clearly not, and when we use the term a tzaddik, that's not what we think about, and I don't think that's what the authors of the Siddur had in mind, and I don't think it's ever, you know, used in that sense. Of course, tzaddik is related to the notion of, or the same word, I know I'm not a grammarian, of tzedakah, of course, and tzedakah mishpat, righteousness. A tzaddik means that's what we call it, a righteous person. And tzedakah, tzedek is righteousness, you know, tzedek, tzedek tirdof, or tzedakah mishpat. So we normally translate, and that's how the commentaries here on the Siddur, what I quoted the Rambam, the Rambam's in Hilchot Teshuvah, the Rambam's not commenting on this blessing. He's just saying in general, that's the difference between a tzaddik and rasha, is 50-50. And then, of course, the idea is that only a benoni, only one is exactly 50-50. So maybe an 8 billion people in the world, how many people are exactly 50-50? I don't know, 20? What's the odds that over the course of the year that they're exactly the same amount of merit points and demerit points? It's like, you know, 1 in 10 billion or whatever it is. Like, that's like almost impossible. Nonetheless, we're supposed to think we're a benoni. Everybody's supposed to think that they're 50-50, but only the people who are truly 50-50, which is basically nobody, that's what Aseret Yemei Teshuvah is for. It's you know, think about it, it's an interesting thing. Just like, by the way, this is a Gemara in Yuma. This actually has more relevance. The Gemara discusses in Yuma that there are four types of sins, and each sin requires a different type of atonement. And only one of those sins really is Yom Kippur, the key factor in play. In other words, We don't have to go through the Gemara inside, but like a positive commandment. If you don't do a positive commandment, so the second you start doing it, you don't have a mezuzah in your house. So you put a mezuzah, fine, I did the mitzvah. Great, that's over. I don't need Yom Kippur, my tshuva, my repentance by putting a mezuzah. That's it, end of the story, I don't need Yom Kippur. If you violated a negative commandment, that's when you need Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur finishes the atonement. That's only if it's a regular negative commandment, eating pork, I don't know, wearing shatnes, you know. But if it's a negative commandment that has a death penalty or karet, like Shabbos or Chametz on Pesach or eating on Yom Kippur, or many of the sexual sins, many of the sins related to idolatry, Yom Kippur doesn't really help. It helps, but it's not enough. The Gemara says you need to have pain and suffering, whatever that means, and then of course a Chilul Hashem, nothing helps until death. Anybody who desecrates God's name, so Yom Kippur really only helps, or Yom Kippur is only sort of the key for someone who violates a regular negative commandment. Okay, that's a lot, but still, it's not like Yom Kippur is like everything's Yom Kippur. No, it's only one of the four types of sins. Anyway, that's let's get back here. What's a tzaddik is one who is what we call. It's interesting. The some say a tzaddik. The Abu Dram says a tzaddik is one who never sins. So that's of course not literal because there's no such thing. There's no such being. Ain tzaddik ba'aretz asher lo yachtat. There's nobody who doesn't sin. And we discussed another occasion. Sin is necessary. Without sin, you can't grow. Right? When the pasuk in Kohelet says ain tzaddik ba'aretz asher yaseh tov lo yachtat. I hope I'm quoting it right. There's no righteous person in the land who does all good and doesn't sin. That's not like a lament. Oh, you know, it's impossible. Okay, it's true. It's impossible. And that's a little bit comforting. You know, you don't, we're not perfect. We're humans. And that's okay. If you sin, you just move on. But it means even more than that. You cannot be a tzaddik unless you sin. If you don't fall off the bicycle, you'll never learn how to ride the bicycle. You know, like, I don't know if that's a good example, but you know what I mean. It's impossible to grow if we don't make mistakes and errors. And that's how all great people, many of the great business people, you know, all had failures before they became famous, not all, but many, before they became great people. But it's very true. It's a very powerful idea that a tzaddik is, by definition, a tzaddik has to be one who sinned, but he learns from his sins. And that's what we say, that a bal tshuva, one who repents from a sin, is on a higher level than one who hasn't sinned. It's many means, but that's one of the ideas. Through sinning, we grow. But obviously, when the Abu Dram says that tzaddik is one who never sinned, he's not meaning it literally. I mean, so we call a religious Jew. He's, you know, it's, we know who are the tzaddikim, the person who never talks in shul and is always in shul on time, and the person doesn't talk lashon hara. You know, there are people like that, very pious people, and that's very beautiful. Okay, what's the Netiv Bina Siddur just quotes? What it's an unique one who chases after righteousness. I like the idea. Rodef. Hatzedek, like we have Rodev Shalom, right? Oev Shalom, Berodev Shalom, right? The Midrash says that many of the mitzvot of the Torah are like by happenstance. Like there's a mitzvah to return a lost object. Okay, when do you return a lost object? If you happen to find the lost object. There's no mitzvah to go look for a lost object to return it. Kiemet say if you find. The Midrash actually says that by the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan, right? To send aside the mother bird is ki kare. If it so happens you're going bird hunting and you come across a mother bird sitting on its egg, don't just take the egg, send it away. But there's no mitzvah. I know they had some article recently, one of these magazines, all these people going bird hunting so they can fulfill this mitzvah. So I don't know, that's not a classical Jewish approach at all. If it happens, you find a lost object, this is what you do. But there's no idea to look. As a matter of fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein goes so far here, I don't know that I agree, who am I, but I don't know other people. This, that Rav Moshe Feinstein says there's not even a mitzvah to make money to give tzedakah. If you happen to have a lot of money, give a lot of tzedakah. But there's no mitzvah to make extra money so he can give more tzedakah. So that already is, I think, more complicated, because I think people have different missions in life. And you've heard, I'm sure you've heard stories where, you know, great people will tell your mission in life is to, you know, make $1 billion and to make day school education free. I only say that because somebody sent me an article yesterday from ePhilanthropy, somebody who is a Baal Teshuva, I guess, someone whose kids went to public school and just moved them to schools. They talked about the gift last year. I forgot the two biggest gifts given in America in 2024 were given by Jews. Ruth Gottesman, is that her name? The one who gave $1 billion to make Einstein Medical School free. And somebody else gave $1 billion. So the person was just commenting, why don't we have a Jewish person to give $1 billion to make day school education free? So there have been efforts, and that is something I've spoken about a lot. In the city of Toronto, with about 10,000 kids in the day school system, we would need, if you want to make it mamish free, like in the public schools, to make it, you never have to raise another penny, you need somewhere between $1.5 billion and $2 billion, which sounds like a lot of money, but it really isn't. I mean, it is a lot of money, but I can, on the top of my head, think of people involved in the Jewish community who could give that money on their own without any help. And their life, and they could still go to Florida for winter break. You know, they wouldn't have to change their lifestyle. Anyways, as I always say, it's easy to give away other people's money. But I only say that because I do think it's true that some people there, that they should make a lot of money. That's, I think, what Rav Moshe is saying is, a chiddush. On a certain level, of course it's true. Your life goal shouldn't be to make money. You live a normal life. And if you happen to be blessed with money, great. But I think for some people it's good. Anyways, we'll leave that aside. But the mitzvah is most mitzvah. If it so happens, this is what you do. The exception, the midrash, this is already the midrash, says not by peace. Bakei shalom v'ratfehu. We have to seek peace. We have to run after peace. It's not enough. What do you mean? If you have an opportunity to solve a dispute between people, no. You have to make those opportunities, and you have to go out of your way to do such a thing. So that's why they says, in the Tibina, that's the Jakobsons, you know, your Siddur, the German, this 6-part series on the Siddur, and the Tibina, very good. Jakobson, I think, is the one who wrote it. So he said, you have to be rodef. Hatzedek. The Hatzedek is one who chases and looks for opportunities to do righteousness. Okay, what's a chassid? How do we traditionally define a chassid? And of course, we're talking before the 1700s. Okay, so how do we traditionally define a chassid? Anybody? So a chassid is traditionally defined as lifnin mishurat hadin. Like in Pirkei Avot, who was it? Rav Yossi, chassid. The classical interpretation, I think, given my most commentaries, does lifnin mishurat hadin, does more than the law requires. We've spoken about this in the past too, just very briefly. The din, the judgment, the law is very straight. Shura, lifnin mishurat hadin. And in a court of law, the judges are not allowed to favor anybody. It's strict justice and can't have any rachmanis. Jews are rachmanim. Jews have mercy on people. A judge is forbidden to have mercy on people. Nebuch, you know, be nice. What do you need? You're the billionaire. You're going to court with some guy who's on welfare. Give me a break. Yeah, of course you're right. But, you know, no, that is forbidden in a court of law. In a court of law, you talk Lashon Hara. Yeah, everything is totally as it is. You can't be nice. Justice, Yikova Din Etahar. Justice pierces the mountain. Lifnin Mishurat Adin just means you have to act before you get to court. You have to act in a way, you know what, I'm not going to sue you. I'm going to be nice to you because of the extenuating circumstances that have no legal merit and low legal holding, still I'm going to be nice to you. So I'm going to do beyond what the law, more than the law requires. But that's really what lifnim mishurat hadin is. Now, what's the classic case? I think when most people, when they think of lifnim mishurat hadin, what's the classic case? Anybody know? I'm sorry?
Chanukah,
you mean, because we do Mahadrin mean HaMahadrin. So first of all, as far as I know, Lifnim Mishurat Adin, I know. Lifnim Mishurat Adin only applies to mitzvah between man and man. There's Hidur mitzvahs, there are chumras, there are things that, at the concept, every example in the Talmud, there are about six of them. I was actually reading, going through all the examples of the Talmud of Lifnim Mishurat Adin. I'm reading, this is a fantastic book. Halacha Kochav Utafkida. This is by Eliezer Berkowitz. I'm sure many of you heard of Eliezer Berkowitz. He was probably one of the top students of the Sri Leish, of Yaakov Weinberg. He was in Chicago for many years, and then he moved to Israel. Philosopher, Talmud Chacham. He's written quite a number of very interesting books. I think he wrote Faith After the Holocaust. No, was that him also? And this book is, I don't think it's translated into English, as far as I know, but he has a whole chapter of Musari, what is it called? It Kocho HaMusari Shel Halacha, the power a proper behavior. I don't know. That's not
moral
a right
power.
Moral power. Thank you very much, Debbie. Derachei HaDerachei. No, the ways are peace. Vasita Yashar V'atov. Lifnim Mishurat Adin. Ruach HaChamim Nochamim. So he goes through and he shows in the Talmud, sometimes they quote the verse Vasita Yashar V'atov. You should do the straight and the good, which Rashi says means Lifnim Mishurat Adin. That's that pasuk in Shmot, in Dvarim, that you should do the Yashar V'atov, the straight and the good. Rashi says it's, you know, Pshar and Lifnim Mishurat Adin, but in the Talmud, this case will say Vasita Yashar V'tov, this case Lifnim Mishurat Adin. There are not so many cases where the Talmud invokes those rules, the classic cases, but they're all, every one of them is between man and man. The idea of Lifnim Mishurat Adin, that concept. There's another concept to do, Hider Mitzvah, yeah. Hider Zei Levan Behu, this is my God and I will glorify him. So there's an idea, let's say, to spend, you can call it a form of Lifnim Mishurat Adin, but it's different. There's an idea you can spend, if you're wealthy, you should spend extra money on the mitzvah. You shouldn't, you can make kiddush, you don't need a silver kiddush cup. You don't need a goblet of silver. But I think everyone here probably has one. Okay, kiddush, you buy it, that's a heder mitzvah. You can be yotze, you have a beautiful menorah, you have a nice etrog case. You know, some people come to shul with the etrog case in the box, in the cardboard box, and some people have a nice silver thing. So what, if you're on a day school subsidy, so you're not allowed to buy a nice silver etrog box. But if you have extra money, so that's Hidur Mitzvah. That's to enhance the mitzvah. So hold on a second. But it's not, but there is no idea of Lifnim Mishurat Adin between man and God. Anyway, but thank you. What, anybody know what? I'm just thinking. I don't know. That's what I always thought.
Rabbi Bar Chana paying the workers who broke the jugs of
100%. Very good. Except it's not 100% accurate based on what I just said. So let's take, very good. That's the classic case. Rabbi Bar Chana, Judy, you want to tell everybody what the actual case was? Or you want me to? I can do it if you want. Okay, I'll you do can. It. That's yeah, okay. So Rabbi Bar Chana, we'll go to the case in a second. Rabbi Bar Chana, so he's a rabbi, owned a wine factory. He was a manufacturer of wine. And he had porters and they're transporting the wine and they broke a big barrel of wine. New big barrel of wine was worth $1,000. They're paid minimum wage. How many you pay a porter in the factory? Pay him $10 an hour. I don't know what minimum wage is in the United States. In Canada, it's like $16. Okay. Here. So, or $17 now. Fine. They don't make $1,000 a day. So Rabbi Bar Chana, the workers and you're responsible. It's the company's not responsible. That's a secular idea that the corporation is responsible for what the person does. No, that's not a Jewish idea. The person who does the damage is responsible. So the workers owe the boss $1,000. So they can't pay. So Rabbi Bar Chana takes their coats. And the workers go running to Rav, the rabbi Rav, like Rav and Shmuel. He says, I think it's Rav. He took our coats. Give us back our coats. It's in the middle of the winter. We're going to freeze. We're in Canada. Okay, maybe they weren't in Canada, but still. So Rav said, give him back the coats. So Rav Archer said, is that the law? And Rav said, yes, that's the law. That's the law, like Lifnim Mishurat Adin. We'll get there in a second. And then the worker said, that's very nice, worker, that we didn't get paid. Get paid. Are you out of your mind? You owe me money. It's bad enough. I can't take your coats for collateral. I'm not going to pay you. And the way I went to Rav, pay them. So pay them. Is that the law? Yeah, that's the law. So if we take a look, which I want to show you now in the Gemara, because I think it's whatever. It's nice. Let me share my screen here. Okay. So if we take a look here. Bava Metzia 83a. Rabbi Bar Chana Hanech Tvarele Hanech Shikule Chavita Dechamri. His porters were carrying bottles of wine. Shakal, okay. So have a link, Li Maichu. Give me your coat. So Amarle Dina Achi. Is this the law? Then it could go, yes. So it says, Leman Telech Mederech Tovim. You should do the path of the good. Okay. Yahuv Lik Limo, they gave him their coats. Amrlei Ani Eyanan, we're poor people. We're poor people. The porters in the factory, how much are they going to make? Tarchinan Kula Yom, we worked really hard. We worked for 8 hours, really hard, schlepping. They're heavy. And okay, we made a mistake. We dropped it. Vikaifina and Vilek Lanmide, we have nothing. We have no food. We have nothing. So they could have gone to the local food bank, but no, it's the employer's responsibility. Amarle Ziv Hav Agrayu, give them their wages. Amarle Dina Hachi, is this the law? Amarle, yeah. Yeah, for Orchot Sadikim, the path of the righteous you shall follow. So what comment? So this is the given as the classic case is the Mishuratim. Wow, it cost a lot of money, and he paid him. They gave him their money, so it's very nice. But if you'll notice, and this is what Dr. Berkowitz, but he's not Tosfot actually points this out there earlier, much earlier, that the Gemara doesn't quote the pasuk. They quote a pasuk in Mishlei. Like, if you want to quote a pasuk in Chumash is more powerful than a pasuk in Mishnah. Mishnah, it's a rabbinic idea. Chumash is, that's powerful. So why don't they quote Vasita Yashar Vatov? There's another pasuk in Yitro that the Gemara says refers to Lifnei Mishurat Hadin, or they don't even use the words Lifnei Mishurat Hadin. So Tosfos points out this is more than Lifnei Mishurat Hadin. Lifnei Mishurat Hadin, one of the places in the Talmud is if you find a lost object, so you have to return a lost object. That's great. But you have to return a lost object, but not after a year you can keep it. How long do you have to guard somebody's lost object? After a year, that's the statute of limitations. So Avuah d'Shmuel, Shmuel's father had kept these animals for a year. That's even harder. And after a year, somebody came and he gave them back to them. He didn't have to. So that's Lifnei Mishurat Hadin. You're just losing profit. You're not losing money. But to ask somebody to give $1,000 to pay the worker who caused me damage, that's a much higher level. That's Orchot Sadikim. That's the path of the righteous. That's a famous Musar book. Orchot Sadikim. It's not a Pasuk in Chumash. You're not obligated. There are different levels, even if Lifnei Mishurat Hadin. We should go beyond what we're required to do, but even that has limits. And it could depend how wealthy you are. And many, many factors. I just want to say that it is a beautiful story and it's a classic story, but you should know that Lifnei Mishurat Hadin doesn't require you to lose a lot of money. That's a tzaddik. Orchot tzaddikim tishmor, the path of the righteous. Lifnei Mishurat Hadin, there's actually a fascinating machlok in the Rishonim. It's almost, what's the word? It's almost an oxymoron. Half the Rishonim, many of the medieval authorities say, we can't force somebody. We advise you, if you're a nice guy, you'll do more than the law requires. But some say we force you to do Lifnei Mishurat Hadin. In other words, the court has the right to force somebody. Okay, well, so that's like kind of an oxymoron. What do you mean? Then it's not beyond the letter of the law because you're forcing him to do it. But leave that debate. But that is a classic debate in medieval authorities, whether a court has we don't have these courts today, but has the theoretical right or the practical right to force somebody to act Lifnei Mishurat Hadin. But no, the court, even though it's true, Rav told him to do that, that wasn't in a court of law. I don't think he would have said that in a court of law, but you know, that's a different level. Okay. Anyways, but when we daven every morning, we have to daven for a tzaddik. Now you'll understand, a chassid is gotta be, he's different. He's greater than one is greater than the other, but he's doing even more. If we want to do what we're saying, the chassid doing is, or maybe it's the tzaddik, or it's tzaddikim, but that's just somebody who's doing way beyond what is required. So we have to daven for the tzaddik. On the one hand, the tzaddik is the person who's 51%, and the reason that doesn't mean it here, because we're going to have that. That's the Aleinu we're going to get to for normal people. The tzaddik is a really somebody who runs after tzedek. The chassid does more than the law requires, Lifnei Mishurat Hadin and beyond. And then we get to the Otzer Tefillah. This I also like. Obviously, we don't know, and obviously there are different words. Nobody knows exactly what it's referring to. So the different commentaries have different ideas. So the Otzer Tefillah Siddur quotes that, you know what a chassid is? He's a man of action. Baal Ma'asim, people who are action. Yeah, people who who learn, people who do all kinds of things. We picture a tzaddik more like that idea. A chassid is the guy involved in the community, bal masim. That's also, I actually think that's a really beautiful explanation. It's not somebody super pious. Someone who, you know, we got problems in our community. He's going to be an activist. He's going to make the Jewish community, the world community, going to make it a lot better. But so we're praying for the people who are doing, you know, who are doing to keep the Jewish community as on a high level as it can be. Okay. Then we have Ziknei Amcha Beit Yisrael, the elders of the nation of the house of Israel. So who are the Ziknei Amcha Beit Yisrael? Now we know a Zakein, Mipnei Seva Vadarta Pnei Zakein. What's a Seva and a Zakein? So there's a debate, and it's, I mean, is a Zakein quantitatively or qualitatively? So Zakein, 80 years old, 70 years old, we have a halacha, Mipnei Seva Takum. So the halacha says the age of 60, you have to stand. That's a real halacha. And Isi Ben Yehuda says even a non-Jew, you have to stand for an aged non-Jew, even a non-Jew pagan, not just a non-Jew, a pagan, because he has life experience they can share with you. Anyways, what that is, but as a Zakein, the rabbis also say, it may mean old, like, you know, chronologically, but the rabbis usually say Zakein is Misha Kana Chokma. It's wise. You can be old in knowledge, but young in years. But then what's the difference? Who are Ziknei Amcha? How are they different from a tzaddik and a chassid? Presuming they're not the exact same thing, otherwise we wouldn't say it. So what, who are Ziknei Amcha? Anybody? So, the commentaries I saw basically said members of the Sanhedrin, okay, or when you absent the Sanhedrin, the leaders of the generation. I was saying before, a chassid may be a lay leader. He's the man of action. A chassid could be one who does lifnei mishurat hadin, one interpretation. There was a man of action. Then you have the leaders of the generation, whether that's the president or the rabbi of the shul, whatever it is. And then he adds, of course, a very important line that we have to stress over and over again, that the leaders, he says, these are the leaders of the generation who are osek im hatzibur l'shem shemaim, that they are involved in community for the sake of heaven. That's what we say every Shabbos morning. V'chol mishos kimitzar chetzibur b'yemuna. You have to be involved in emuna. And we've mentioned many, many times, It's a scary thought, think about politicians, all of them, 99.9999% of them. The Shem Shemai means you do, in the Shulchan Aruch, they define in politics what the Shem Shemai is. We have the Shem Shemai for the sake of heaven. What does that mean? So I can tell you a halachic application. I should have referred to them. Maybe we'll do it afterwards. In Choshen Mishpat 163, It says like this. Let's say you have a community. You're on your local neighborhood, committee, and they're deciding should they spend money to build a library, or should they spend on the ice skating rink, or should they keep the theater, the orchestra going. They don't have enough money to do all this. So it's why everybody's arguing. So everybody's got to do this, and then what are you going to do? So it says in the Shulchan Aruch. It's in the Shulchan Aruch. It says what do? You everybody states their opinion. Everybody gets up to the microphone, can say what they want, and then you take a vote, and you have to vote the Shem Shemaim. In other words, you cannot vote. Your kid takes violin lessons, so you want them to hire a great violin teacher, right? No, you have to vote what's best for the community. I'm in the industry. Okay, we're going to, the Canadian, probably in 2 weeks, I don't know what's going to be with our economies, 25% tariffs and all this. So you're in the wrong industry and you're going to be really impacted. So how do people vote? People vote what's good for me. He's going to lower taxes on the wealthy. So I'm wealthy. I vote for him. No, they're going to lower taxes on the poor. So I'm poor. I vote for them. So you have to vote what's best for the whole society, not what's best for you. So this is, I believe, one of the hardest halachot in all of Shulchan Aruch to follow. One of the most neglected halachot. And who does that? That's like next to impossible. You're asking a person to vote what's not in their best interest, because they understand that what's in their best interest is for them good, but it's not good for the community at large. So you're not allowed to vote like that. That's like, wow. Wow. So that's the L'shem Shemayim. No, that's one thing when we vote. But the leaders, they really have to do this. Because, and that's why the Ziknei Amcha Beit Yisrael are the leaders of the generation. And he says, or Osek L'shem Shemayim. Because a leader by definition hurts people. You cannot be a leader if you don't hurt people. Then you're not a leader. Then you're like, you have leaders. They don't do anything. They're afraid to do anything because they're going to upset somebody. Well, a leader means you take tough decisions. You're doing the budget. Yeah, you're going to have to hurt people. You're deciding how we're going to have 25% tax. So our premier of Ontario is calling an election. Those who live in Canada know what I'm talking about. Calling an election next week. Anybody knows we don't need an election. He claims he has a year and a half until the next election. It's not like in the U.S., they're fixed dates. So, but his term goes for a year and a half because he claims he needs a mandate. He's going to deal with the Trump terrorists. He needs a mandate. He has a huge mandate, all the oppressions, but he knows he's high in the, there are all kinds of, I'm not going to get into the politics of it. People in Canada know, in Ontario know the politics of it. But he's calling an election now because it suits him. It's good for him and whatever. So, but you have to make decisions. There are going to be 25 terrorists. Are we going to put terrorists back? What are we going to do? You have to hurt people. And that's not only fine, that's obligatory. You cannot be a leader if you don't hurt people. But if you're going to hurt people, you better do it l'shem shemayim. You're hurting people because you're gaining more people. Because you're going to, the only way to help the majority is to hurt the minority. There are ways to help everybody. And then there are things that really are a zero sum game. There are some things that have to do cutbacks in the budget. So either the cutbacks are going to be in the military, going to be in education, going to be in healthcare. You can't do everything. It's impossible. So you have to do l'shem shemayim. So that's why it's really, really important. And Rav Schachter used to stress to us all the time, you know, you want to become a shul president, you want to become a rabbi. He would say, you want to write a book, you want to write a sefer. Who's interested in your sefer? You have to do it l'shem shemayim. It has to be done because you feel it's for the sake of heaven. That's hard to do. But anyways, that's Ziknei Amcha Beit Yisrael, the elders. It has this, and maybe when people are older, they are more likely to act the shame shemayim. They're, no, it's coming to an end. They've got to give an accounting before God. They can't take with them. You're young and ambitious and aggressive and, you know, all those things. It's hard to act the shame shemayim. I think when, as you get older, maybe it's a little bit easier. But Ziknei Amcha Beit Yisrael, these are the leaders of the generation who have an obligation to act not what is necessarily good for them, what they feel is good for the majority of the people. Okay, now let's get to what I think Yocheva mentioned a couple weeks ago, Pleitat Sofreyam, Rav Soloveitchik's beautiful explanation of Pleitat Sofreyam. What's the Sheirit HaPleita, that's what we call Holocaust survivors, the remnant of the, those who were destroyed. So this is the remnant of the Sofreyam, the remnant of the scribes. So what are the remnants of the scribes? Well, what's a remnant? First of all, we have to describe what a scribe is, but that'll do later. But pleitat, the leftovers of the scribes. So I'm just going to read a little bit because I didn't see this in English. This is from Shirei HaRav, a number of lectures Rav Soloveitchik gave. And this is the Rav, as we discussed, was the greatest maspid in Jewish history. Maybe I'm exaggerating only slightly. I find it hard to believe there was a greater speaker than the Rav in any time in Jewish history giving hespedim. He was electrifying and the insights. His hespedim are very famous. The eulogies he gave for Amazing Heller. So this is a eulogy for Rav Chaim Heller. Who here knows who Rav Chaim Heller was? So Rav Chaim Heller, I had to look it up again. Rav Chaim Heller was one of these autodidacts, I think. He was like a tremendous Talmud Chacham, old European style Talmud Chacham, but he had a tremendous interest. He studied Jewish scholarship, manuscripts, all this, very into Jewish scholarship. And he, when the Rav was in Berlin, I think he sort of ran a quasi yeshiva for these great gedolim, who all congregated. Berlin in the 1920s and 1930s, I told you, Nechama Leibowitz told us, when we asked her, did she know Rav Soloveitchik from the University of Berlin? said, a little bit, not so much. I don't know, whatever. She said, yeah, I used to sit here. He used to sit there in the library. But he said, we heard Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's son is coming to the University of Berlin. Rav Huttner was in Berlin. Lahavdil, or maybe not Lahavdil, I don't know, going to Harvard, you know, but we're all the Gedolei Yisrael, you know, went to Harvard, and they're all there. These are all brilliant people, all interested, not just they're interested primarily in learning Torah, but they're also interested in learning general knowledge, wisdom. And that's why they're all going in the university. And so Chaim Heller, I think he sort of ran a yeshiva for them. He was their teacher. And when he came to New York, he came to YU. I don't know exactly if he had an official position, Mashkiach, but the story goes he would speak for 2 minutes. Nobody could understand him. And Rav Soloveitchik would speak for 20 minutes to explain what he said. In 2 minutes. He was like from this old school, you know, Rav Soloveitchik became an American. You know, he knew about baseball and, you know, all those other things. But Rav Chaim Heller, I never met him. He passed away, I think, in 1960 or so. He was sort of the old style European. So the Rav, in his eulogy for Chaim Heller, talks, I think Dr. Belkin had said he's the Platetz of Rehem. Chaim Heller is the prototype of Platetz of Rehem. So the Rav explains that's the leftovers, the remnants of the prior generation, the link to the past. Platetz of Rehem are those great people who link us to the past. Like I said, he was an old style, you know, link. As things change all the time, but you need links to the past. So I'll just read a little bit from this. I hope not too much because I don't know if it's online anywhere. I didn't find it, but maybe it is. Okay, it does not matter how many Talmidei Chachamim, Gedolim, or writers, with all the sweep and scope of their Torah creativity, a generation is blessed with. It cannot be linked to the great chain of tradition unless it includes a remnant of scribes from the lofty past, bridging the gap between the generations. There can only be tradition where the individual becomes the interaction of eras. To transmit and to receive is to enfold the generation in the religious present. Now is to be anchored in the once. In every generation, we meet miraculously the soul of an ancient generation planted in the present, emanating the aura of the venerable, the beauty of the age. Living figures wander, they roam from generation to generation. Tradition includes not only theoretical innovations, abstract concepts, halakhic formulas, and logical principles, but also types of being, feelings, and reactions, a certain existential rhythm and experiential continuity. Okay, you get the idea, I think, right? And then, so Rav Chaim Heller was the link to the past. This old style, that's what he needs. And then he says that's who Serach Bat Asher was. If you know Serach Bat Asher, the Midrash, that's the one who the Midrash, there are only two women mentioned in the 70 people who go down to Egypt. So obviously there were way more. Because it says last week in Parshat Shmot, Ishu Beito, what did it say? They came with their families. So it can't have 68 men and two women. You can't have such a family like that. But for whatever reason, the Torah, when it lists us only men, except for Dinah, okay, I get Dinah. She was an actual child of Yaakov. But, and Serach Bat Asher. Serach Bat Asher. So obviously the rabbis, like, there must be something about her. So the rabbis portray Serach Bat Asher. She was the one who told Yaakov Avinu that Yosef was alive. And then she is in the time of Moshe. I forget already what the Medrash said. She didn't time Moshe. But they have her as sort of, that's her Rav Soloveitchik. She's the link of all the generation. I think, okay, one more thing that I think ties into something, the Rav doesn't say it here, but based on other things we've said in the name of the Rav, I think that ties into our Gemara over here. Let me just find it. I've said a number of times that Rav Soloveitchik was very anti-innovation in prayer. He said, we don't have the right to institute prayers. You need prophets. So this is the Gemara I spoke about right at the beginning of the Shir, that the beginning of Shmon Esrei is from the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah in the 6th century BCE. So, and the time in Rabban Gamliel. This is this double, you know, whether they forgot it, they did it. Shimon HaPakuli, the garment manufacturer, made the Shmon Esrei Brachot we spoke about in the past. Livnei Rabban Gamliel B'Yavneh. So that's in the third century. And Rav Yochanan said, no, but we learned that May of Esrim Zekanim, that's the Anshei Knesset Agdola, 100 people, Ubahem Kama Nevi'im, and they had some prophets. And Rav Soloveitchik makes a big deal about that. Well, only because there were prophets with the transitional generation. Prophecy ended as the second temple was built. The second temple was built. The leaders were the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. So there's a transition from the Nevi'im to the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. And they were the ones, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah made the Shmoneh Esrei, but they could only do it because they had the Nevi'im. And that's, of course, what I would say, that's the Pleitas of Ephraim. The Nevi'im were the ones who, who were the remnant of the past, the first temple, where there was direct revelation from God to people. I mean, the change from a prophecy to non-prophecy is humongous. It's a humongous change. God spoke to Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu. I spoke to all the people. And okay, in the time of the second is Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, the last of the prophet. And all of a sudden, now we have the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. God doesn't speak to anybody anymore. We have no prophecy. So it's a humongous change. And so you need that link in the generation, which of course is the meaning of the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that we all know by heart. Moshe got the Torah from Sinai, gave it to Yeshua, the Yeshua, this Ganim, it's Ganim Nevi'im. This Ganim to the Nevi'im, Nevi'im Masrul Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. That's the Shmoneh Esrei. The Nevi'im gave it to the 120 people to the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. So that's the notion of, I think it's a beautiful idea. You can read, I don't know if I can find it online, but read the beautiful eulogy that the Rav gave for Rav Chaim Heller. That the Pleitas of Ephraim, we always need, we all know this instinctively. You don't need Rav Soloveitchik to tell us the importance, just the way he formulates it, that our tradition and all families were dependent. You have to have a link to the past. You have to have a live link. That was the tragedy of the Holocaust. That's, I guess, Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav Sanz article, Rupture and Reconstruction. We had to reconstruct Judaism. I'm just thinking of this now, actually. It really fits in. Badly, very, very, very beautifully. Chaim Soloveitchik's article, the famous article, Rupture and Reconstruction, about the changes, the shift to the right, everything, text-based tradition, is because we lost the Pleitas Reim. And you know what? The Judaism we recreated is not, I don't want to say it's no relation, living or dead. That's not true. It has lots of relation, but it's not the same. We've created post-World War II, Orthodoxy has created an Orthodoxy that never existed before. This is not the Orthodoxy of before the war. It's a totally different, and it's a much more extreme Orthodoxy today than it ever was. So that's because we lost the Pleitas of Ephraim. That's the rupture and reconstruction. The Rav says a tradition can only be maintained if you have the link, and we lost that link. I never actually thought of it this way. Thank you. That after World War II, we lost the Pleitas of Ephraim. Obviously Chaim Heller, obviously we had some, but you know what I'm saying? Most people, someone like Devin with Shul, I think I mentioned before, I remember years ago he said in his class growing up, he grew up in New York, in Borough Park, I think, when it was more modern community, he lives here now, said not one kid in his class had a grandparent. There was nobody in his class who had a grandparent. It's like unbelievable. It's like, wow. Wow, no grandparents. Not one person in a class, I know, 25, 30 kids, not one kid had a grandparent. So that's the loss of Pleitas Ephraim. So we pray because we need that link to the past so we can go on. Changes happen. The Nevi'im and Anshei Knesset HaGdolah is totally different. We have a state of Israel, totally different. How do we live our life? Totally different. So how are we gonna navigate that? That's not at all simple. So we need new blood, that's what Rav Soloveitchik said, that's why Rav Soloveitchik was Rav Soloveitchik, that's why he became modern. And there's Rav Soloveitchik said, God Paskind, he said should you be a Zionist or not, God Paskind, after the war in creative Israel, you should be a Zionist. That's what Rav Soloveitchik says. Sometimes history decides what the halacha is supposed to be. We don't know on these broad question. We're not talking if the tuna is kosher. That's not what we're talking about. But on the much more important questions, policy, direction, and what we're going to do. So sometimes you can't ask a rabbi. History will tell you what the psak halakha. History says there is a state of Israel. So we got to change. We're not living in the pre-war. That's the problem we have today. Many of the people in Israel think we are living in a pre-state. So they have a whole different attitude, obviously. I don't have to elaborate. I think we all understand. But anyways, that's that's this beautiful idea. We pray for the tzaddik, the chassid, the pnimi shur adin, someone who does wonderful things, someone who acts l'shem shemaim, acts for the sake of heaven, puts communal interest above their own personal interest, which is very hard to do, and someone who has that link to the past as they teach the future. Okay, now, who are Sofreihem? Okay, that's very nice. Now, I sort of said, but Sofreihem in the Talmud, what's Pleitas Sofreihem? It's an interesting expression. So who are Sofreihem?
Scribes.
I'm sorry?
Scribes.
Scribes. So what are scribes? The remnants of the scribes. Well, we don't know how to write the Sefer Torah anymore. So Taka, we'll see in 1 second. We don't. That is true.
Our whole tradition depends on correct carrying forward what was written earlier.
Okay, excellent.
Correct transmission. Right.
Transmission. Scribes are what? So very good. They're the scribes. They're the ones who write the Torah, who tell us what we do. They write text. They tell us what we have. For sure. So let's just take a look at the Gemara here in Kiddushin. So this is on the Gemara, on the obligations of a parent to a child and teaching Torah. Where are we here? Kiddushin 38. Okay, I'll just do it the line before. This is a classic line, really needs a whole class on its own. Lo'olam yishalesh adam shnotav. A person should divide his life, it sounds like his years, shnotav, into three. Shlish b'mikra, the first third of his life, he should learn Tanakh. From five to whatever. Shlish b'mishnah. Mishnah means the law. Shlish b'talmud. Talmud means the analysis, the conceptualization. So the Gemara says, that's very nice, but miyotek, how long, nobody knows how long they're going to live. So how many years do you give these? No, I mean, lo tzricha liyome. It means every day. Every day you have 2 hours shir in Tanakh, 2 hours shir. However, you can learn 3 hours a day. So learn 1 hour Tanakh, 1 hour Mishnah, 1 hour Talmud. That's what you're supposed to do. What's the problem with this? Nobody does this anymore. Who does this? So that's what I mean. We need a whole shear. But just let me show you. I don't know if Tosfot, I have it in English. You know, this is not this class. Let's see Tosfot says. So Tosfot says, Peirush Bekuntri Shemei HaShabbat. So Rashi says, it doesn't mean every day, it means every week. Okay. 2 days. 2 days, two, and two, and on Shabbos year review, whatever, fine. Baloney Hebrew, okay, fine. Tosfot doesn't like that because maybe you'll die in the middle of the week. I don't know, that question doesn't bother me. Okay, it's not 100% exact, but Tosfot, maybe you'll die in the middle of the day. So Tosfot says, so he says, B'chol Yom Atzmo, every day, like I said, an hour each day. Okay, and that's why we have, and we discussed this way when we started, B'chol Yom, before Pesuk Yedi Zimra, we do Talmud Torah. We quote Yivarach Hashem Yishmerach. We quote from the Mishnah. We quote from the Talmud. So every day when you dove, when you open up your Siddur, you fulfill this obligation. Now, the problem is that's not what it sounds like to mumble one verse and one Mishnah and one Talmud thing, right? So a Mishnah and Rabbeinu Tam, this is a famous Rabbeinu Tam. Anu Somchim, we rely Bavel. Why it's called? It's a fascinating. It's like Moshe's name. It's like an Egyptian name. You know, what do you mean, Mishitiu? It's a whole different language. So it's the same thing here. He's saying Bavel, Blula v'mikra, the Babylonian Talmud. The word Bavel, which means Babylonia, in Hebrew means it's mixed. So you don't have to learn. You don't have to learn Mishnah and Tanakh because it's all included in the Gemara. This is whatever. I don't want to. There's a lot to talk about that, and that's of course what Ashkenazic about who that's all they learn in yeshivas, just Gemara. You know, Gemara includes Tanakh. We know that's not really true. I mean, if you learn Gemara really properly, look at everything, but whatever it is, that's the Rabbeinu Tam trying to justify this practice why nobody learns Tanakh, you know. No, it's included. That's what Talmud Bavli. Okay.
Where were you just quoting from?
Talmud, it's Kiddushin 38, you can see that. If you go to Sepharia, Kiddushin 38. This is they're beautiful Gemaras here. This is about a lot of Gemaras about this is where a lot of the Gemaras are about teaching Torah. It's the sixth obligation from a parent to a child. So the Gemara was, I'm sorry? So 38 in Kiddushin. Yeah, somebody was asking me a question.
I just happen to have my corn sitting next to me.
Sure.
And I was looking up how they translate Sofreihem. And they don't say scribe, they say scholars,
Okay. And you know what? You're right. I called my title, I titled this lecture, The Remnant of the Scholars. Okay. So very good. Thank you. So the truth, and we'll see. So some do say Sofri means a scholar, but that's also Zignamcha. You're right. It includes scholars, but the word so fair doesn't, that's not really what we refer to when we say a silver. You're right. My sitter also says the remnants of the scholars. And that's really how I was explaining what Rav Soloveitchik is saying. You need a link to great scholars of the previous generation. 100%. Thank you. At the same time, so fair also has this sort of specialized meaning. So if you look in the Gemara, Lama Nikru Rishonim Sofrim. Why were the early scholars called Sofrim? And here they're like, you know, really Sofrim. Shayu Sofrim Kolotiyot Shabbatorah. Wow. They would count all the letters of the Torah. So it obviously means more. They knew the Torah backwards and forwards, and therefore they could teach. Shayu Rim Vav de Gachon. The letter Vav in the word Gachon, which is in Vayikra somewhere, the middle of Vayikra, that's half the letters of the Torah. Shall say for Torah. Darosh, darosh. I once gave a drasha on this, right? Darosh, darosh. You should seek out, Moshe, it's talking with Aaron also. It's not far from it. It's not the same. See, 1142 and 1016. Chetzian shel tevot, half the letters of the Torah when you come to Darosh Darosh. Vit galach, and the word vit galach, that's halfway in the psukim of the Torah. So that's what the Gemara says. Okay. And then the Gemara says, this is just fascinating. Also, we need a separate class. Vav de gacha mehai gisa mehai gisa. Hold on a second. When you say it's the middle letter of the Torah, is that, I assume they're saying the Torah has an equal number of letters. So you can't have a middle point if you have four letters. Is it two or three? I mean, you have 100 letters. There's no middle. It's 150. Hold on a second. Right. Is it 50 or 51? The 50th letter or the 51st letter? Which is it, from this side or from that side? So they say, well, why don't we just count? Well, let's pull out a Sefer Torah. We'll put it in a computer program. Okay. We're the computer, and we'll count. So the Gemara says, Rava Bar Bar Chana. Oh, isn't that the same Rava Bar Chana on the wine case? That's pretty cool, right? It's the same one, right? Same Rava Bar Chana who owned the wine factory. I think it's him. Let me just check. Rava Bar Chanan. I don't know now. I don't know. Is Bar Chana and Bar Chana the same person? I really have no idea. That's interesting. Okay, maybe not. Lo zazu mishama sheviu Sefer Torah. So they sat there for 6 years and they counted all the letters in the Sefer Torah. So, and then they said, you know, nah, amrlu eno inu b'kiyi b'chatzeirot v'yitevr anu. And they said, you know what? I don't care that you counted. It doesn't mean anything. They knew, the earlier generations knew when there should be a vav, when there shouldn't be a vav, when there's a silent hey, when you don't put a hey, anu lo b'kinan. We do not know exactly how the Torah should be written. This is a very, as you can understand, a very important Gemara for those, you know, the Rambam says we have the exact same Sefer Torah. Here you have the Gemara saying, we don't really know. We're not experts. They were experts in deficient and plain forms of words and therefore could count the letters. We can't do that. We don't know. We don't know that our Sefer Torah is the exact same amount of letters. But anyways, the Sofrim were the people who, the Gemara says, who counted the letters of the Torah. Every letter was important. That's this idea. Every word in the Torah has significance. And we've discussed, that's a debate. Is it really true? Rabbi Shmuel says, no, Dibrat Torah Kol Shom B'nei Adam. The Torah talked like people. You don't have to go crazy why there's an extra word here. That's just the way people talk. But we're much more trained and we're taught the approach of Rabbi Akiva. Every et has an extra meaning. Okay, fine, beautiful. But the Sofrim counted every single letter of the Torah. And, it's interesting. Divrei Sofrim. We have this expression, Divrei Sofrim. So we read the Megillah. That's a mitzvah Divrei Sofrim. Divrei Sofrim, it's higher than rabbinic law. It's not just some rabbi. It's not just like Rabbi Gamliel in the third century, you know, telling you to do a law, or the rabbis in the Gemara. I mean, it's higher level. Divrei Sofrim is a higher level of rabbinic law. It's not biblical law. That's considered the, in other words, they count the letters. They derive laws from the extra words and the Torah. So Divrei Sofrim is a reference to, rabbinic law. They're the expounders of law, but I think it's connected. People who count the Torah. Now in the, Otzer Tfilot Siddur, and he says, what's a Sofrim? Sofrim are the Melamdei Tinokot. the suffering, what you were saying before, are the scholars, Marty, the scholars. They're the ones who teach our children. The teacher, Pleitas Sofreyem, is a reference to one who teaches, which is kind of like what the same idea, the remnant, the connection to the past. It's a slightly different, you know, idea, but teaching the next generation, the link from generation to generation. So this, so the Sofreyem are those who teach Torah now to children. Now I just want to spend, it's getting late, but, a couple of minutes, you know, teaching Torah to children is very special, is more special to teaching Torah than teaching Torah to adults. How do I know that? So I didn't bring the Gemara here, but the Gemara says, right? If they came right now and tell us they're building the Beit HaMikdash, so you'd get, I hear Delta's resuming flights to Israel April 1st. Okay, Baruch Hashem. I wish your Canada would follow, United, whatever. Okay, but so you want to get on a plane and go to Israel, right? If you're teaching children, No. The Beit HaMikdash can wait. Who cares? We don't disrupt Torah children. And Eino, and then he says, Eino la mikayim, ela vehevel tinokot shel Beit Rabban. The Gemara says, the world only exists because of the heir, the hevel tinokot shel Beit Rabban. The students, the young children learning Torah. You have to teach grade one, which nobody likes to do because they're little kids. But that's the ultimate. You know, Rav Soloveitchik used to go in Maimonides. I was never there, but this is what I was told. He would go on Friday mornings to Maimonides and walk into the class in grade three and tell the kids about Parshat HaShavua. What amazing. Can you, most grade three, wait, you go to grade three student, give me a Rav Soloveitchik, and that's Rav Soloveitchik always spoke. Everybody could understand him. Other great rabbinic studies, they spoke only to the elite. If you weren't have totally grounded in Gemara, you didn't know anything. The lonely man in the faith, one of Rav Soloveitchik's famous lectures, was given at a Catholic university. I mean, that's who he delivered the lecture to, a bunch of Catholics. Again, some, you know, they would go to maybe it was grade one in Maimonides, I don't know, but he would go in Maimonides to the little kids and teach them Parshas Shavua. Such a beautiful idea. The Melamdei Tinokot, something very, very special about learning, the children. Maybe I'll say one last thing and then we'll have to, it's interesting. So we know, we talked about Rodev Shalom, Ohev Shalom, that the difference, it's most mitzvot, if they happen to come. But we say here, Rodfei Tzadek, you run after righteousness. The Medrash says the only mitzvah you run after is peace. And we know peace is so important. It's the be-all and end-all. Everything we do, Marakad Moshe B'Shalom, is, you know, that we're, of course, Aaron, we're allowed to lie for peace, right? Everybody knows that. We're allowed to lie for peace. What's the one exception? You're not allowed to lie for peace. So here, let's just quickly do this. We want, there's a Gemara in Yevamot, 63a in Yevamot. So maybe we'll pick up on that. We don't have time to get into the whole context, but the Gemara tells the following story. The Gemara starts, this is the sugya of getting married. How many kids you have to have. It's all about marriage. So the Gemara has a lot of discussion about marriage. And the Gemara says, here, this is really sad. Maybe I shouldn't quote it, but Amar Leh Rachmana, Rav was leaving Rav Chiya. And Amar Leh, and so Rav Chiya said to Rav, Rachmana Lislach, we made the kashim, that God should save you from a fate worse than death. Right? Rachmana Lislach, we made the kashim, save you something worse than death. So he says, what's worse than death? I laughed. He says, Umotzani Marmi Mavet Elisha. The woman is worse than death. You have a terrible marriage, it's worse than death. That's the matzah isha matzah tov. That's what they used to ask when you get married. Matzah or motze, right? Matzah isha matzah tov. You find a wife, you find goodness in life, brings you happiness. Or motze ani marmi mavet at isha. So that's, of course, it's a very whatever. So it's in this context. So the Gemara tells a story about people, some of the great scholars had not good marriages. So Sichia obviously had a bad marriage. That's why he's telling Rav, God should save you from this terrible fate of death. Because, you know, and what's worse than bad marriage? So the Gemara says, Kigada Chia Bray, so the Gemara had said, I'm sorry. No, the other way. Rav, right, Rav Kametzar Leit Veto, his wife would drive him nuts. I saw the story before. When his wife would ask, what do they say? Pea soup or lentil soup? I don't know. He says, when Rav's wife would aggravate him, when he would say, prepare me lentils, she would prepare him peas. He asked for peas, she would prepare lentils. Just to drive him crazy. So, son, when he got older, he flipped it. So, Rav wanted pea soup. So, he went to his mother and said, make lentil soup. Oh, lentil soup, I'll make pea soup. So he won. So Amar Le, Ayelach Ima, your mother's getting better. She's making me the soup I want. Amar Le, no. I tricked her. Now, why did he say that? I tricked her. I said pea soup when I know you wanted lentil soup, so she would make lentil soup. So Amar Le, Haini the Kamarach, Injit, Panafik Mine, Tama Malfa, Atlo Tabinachi. It says like this. He says, yes, that's, I should have thought of it myself. That's what Rav said, but okay. I didn't think of it, but you shouldn't do that. At lo tavid hachi. Do not do that. Shenamar limdu lishonam. You teach your children to speak falsehood. All kinds of terrible things happen. Commit an iniquity. What happened lying for the sake of peace? That you're allowed to lie for the sake of peace. What greater peace? Shalom bayit. Husband and wife. Why couldn't he lie? So the commentaries point out that because he was a kid, and kids are developing character, and if a kid starts to lie, it's finished. His life is ruined. You got a character. Once you're 15 years old, your character is hard to change. I don't know what the utter limit is. I mean, you can change. He's an adult, but it's really, really, really hard. That's Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's famous line that it's easier to learn the entire Talmud than to change one character trait. So with children, it's true. Normally peace, you can lie for peace, but you can't tell a child to lie for peace. You can never tell a child to lie. Yeah, an adult understands their white lies, and sometimes, you know, life is complex and sometimes the nuances. Kids don't understand that. Kids see the world in black and white. So that's a beautiful idea. Teaching children. When we teach children, first of all, we can never interrupt the teaching. The world exists because adults are corrupt and cynical, and we're all, you know, the bad traits we have. Because ain't tzaddik bards, we all sin. Kids are pure and holy. Kids are special. They can become really pure, but they have to. It's character. Who cares if they know an extra pasuk and chumash, an extra Rashi, how many mishnayos they learn? Doesn't matter. Limdu lishonam. You have to teach kids character development, and that's the Rashi. That's the first Rashi in Bereishit. Naaseh Adam b'tzalmenu. God says to the angels, right? In the famous, what do you mean, Naaseh? Let us make man. That's heretical. What do you mean, let us make man? Who's God's partner? So Rashi says he's teaching the people midot. You should always consult with other people. What do you mean? But somebody might become a heretic because of that. No, it's worth it. It's more important to teach character than to worry somebody will become a heretic. So I'll become a heretic, but I'll have a good character. And that's much more important. So this is a powerful idea, a very important idea, but I'll play Tatsof Rehem, the link to the past, to the Rav Chaim Heller, to the past, to the European generation, to teach us, but the link to the future, teaching our children. Okay, let's just quickly review, and then I'll take any comments. Okay, so we discuss all what the different thing. At tzaddik, a chassid, at tzaddik, it's more than 51%. That's the Ramban, but in this context, it's somebody who is a tzaddik, righteous, doesn't sin. Avurim Zem never sins. That's impossible. Sin is necessary. We need to sin to grow. But they say rodev tzedakah, to run after tzedakah, and really the only thing we generally run after is peace. You don't go looking bird hunting so you can fulfill a mitzvah. I never went bird hunting in my life. I haven't fulfilled a mitzvah. Big deal. I have other mitzvot it's important to fulfill. If I happen to go bird hunting one day and I'll do the mitzvah, I'll be very happy. I don't know. I don't think I would be. I don't. Bird hunting doesn't appeal to me. But okay. Anyway, so if it happens, achasid lifnei mishurat hadin. Lifnei mishurat hadin is the law, and then the law is can be cruel sometimes because the law has to be pierced the mountain, can't take into account extenuating circumstances. So you have to act before you get to court, before you get to the straightness of the law. But lifnei mishurat hadin has limits. The famous case, the beautiful case, the guy, even though you caused damage, I'm going to pay you, and you're not going to pay me, which, by the way, most law, I think Western law, that's how it works. The employee does damage. He doesn't have to pay for it here. But whatever, that's even more than lifnei mishurat hadin. That's orchat tzadikim. That's an expectation. That's too high to expect people. Zik Neyamcha, we discussed the elders of our people, the leaders of the generation. Everybody should act the Shem Shemayim, but no, the average person doesn't, not the end of the world. We all, nobody's 100%. We cannot be. Lo'olam. We should always do mitzvot shelo lishma, because from lo lishma to shma. Of course, but the greater the leader are, when you make decisions that impact on others, like leaders do, it's really, really important to act the Shem Shemayim, because you have to hurt people. Otherwise, you're not a leader. If you're not hurting people, you're not a leader. Of course, if you're not helping people, then you get rid of you as a leader. Obviously, the idea is you're helping more people than you're hurting, but you're hurting some people. And we said in the Shulchan Aruch, it says, maybe I'll bring it up for next week, that it says that you have to vote L'Shem Shemayim. Amazing, amazing. Can't vote for what's good for you. Only you have to vote for what's good for the community at large. Unbelievable. Okay, and then we discussed Pleitat Sofrim, the Rav Soloveitchik's beautiful idea, the link to the past. We need the visions. We need Yaakov, Yosef in Egypt, seeing an image of his father. Believe me, Yosef and Yaakov couldn't be more different. And that's why they don't talk to each other for 17 years. They were so far apart, on whatever, tragically in many ways. But there's no connection between Yosef and Yaakov. I mean, then recorded in the Chumash, because Yosef was raised to power in the Egyptian court. We know that. The kids, parents immigrated to America. They're Yiddish speakers. They speak a broken English. It's hard. It's hard. There's a real gap. But you need that. You need that link to the past to build on the future, and then teaching our children, of course, and counting every letter of the Torah, even though we don't know the exact letters of the Torah. That's what we have to do. Okay, let me took a look at the chat books. I think Sarah Bat Asher told Moshe. Oh, yeah, very good. Yeah, where Moshe, I knew she told Moshe something. I couldn't remember. Thank you very much. Yeah, she told Yaakov that it's the same idea, of course, that Yosef is alive and then where he gets buried. I think it's even later, though. Sarah Bat Asher thinks later in Midrashim. I agree, it's a medrash, and there were secret words to say to cause Yosef's brother to rise up from the Nile. Oh, maybe. Okay. She really loves Moshe. Thank you. Okay. I think one girl in my class had a grandparents. Wow. Wow. You also didn't have any grandparents, Susan?
I didn't have, and I don't know. I think one of my friends had one.
Wow. Okay. I mean, I knew three of my grandparents. My father's father passed away when my father was 9. I'm named for him, but that was in 1936 in Toronto. Wow. I was one of the only girls in my class in Brooklyn. Okay. Wow. Very nice, Debbie. You're lucky. Two full sets of grandparents. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's Pleitat Sofrim. Yeah. What about the impact of the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Okay, in Brooklyn was a great secular scholar before inheriting. I'm not sure what the question is. Yes, Lubavitcher Rebbe probably had more impact than any other teacher of Torah in the 20th century. He still does. He hasn't been alive for 30 years. Well, depends who you ask. But he still has more impact than probably anybody. It's amazing. You don't have to like the Bible. It's not like the Bible. Whatever. It has nothing to do with what you think. It's amazing. It's amazing. And his impact. You know, ask a secular Jew what rabbi they can name. They haven't heard of Rav Soloveitchik, and they for sure haven't heard of Rav Chaim Kanievsky or Rav Avadji Yosef. That was my next comment, Rabbi Sachs. Draw every Dvar Torah anybody gives today. I say it's too much of a crutch, Rabbi Sachs. But it shows you how great Rabbi Sachs was. He was a Kiddush Hashem because he could speak Torah in a language that you didn't have to be an Orthodox Jew, you know, I'm just saying how people perceive it. You could be an educated, worldly, reform, humanist Jew, and you could relate to Rabbi Sachs, despite the fact that he wore a kippah, and when he was obviously identified as Orthodox, he presented Orthodoxy in such a beautiful light that so few people could do. There were people who did it, but it's also in the era of social media, so he gets greater play. Yeah, we have a speaker in our shul, the Shabbos, who is one of the Sachs scholars. You know, they have this program now. They take a bunch of people every summer, and they Sachs scholars, whatever. So, but the Lubavitcher Rebbe, everybody's heard of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Like any Jew who knows they're Jewish, I think, has heard of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Whatever, yeah, it's amazing. Okay, what about the impact of the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Yeah, he was a great scholar. Yeah, he went to university. He had a degree in engineering, and he worked. He worked before he was the rabbi. He worked on the Brooklyn somewhere in Brooklyn before he became the rabbi. And I think that's it. All right. If anybody has any questions, thank you very much. And Monday night, just sort of our new series, Mark Shapiro on the Langer Affair. That's a fascinating, messy, of course, unfortunately. You know, some of the debates with the rabbis can get messy, but when he was allowed, people have been declared mamzer. So he told me he's going to take about 10 weeks because he's going to introduce us to a lot of the Gedolei Torah of that generation who spoke on the issue, and then we have all our regular classes. But I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. It should be a good Shabbat. I think they're supposed to release 4 hostages, right, on Saturday. I don't know what to think about anything, but just let's hope, have peace. I don't know what to think. You know, it's, everything. The whole world is, ain't not only me, Elisha, ain't El Avinu Shev Shemaim. We have to daven for the Tzadikim and the Pleitzot Sofrim and Aleinu. That God should Yehamu Rachamecha, as we'll pick up next week. God should show his mercy upon us.
Amen.
This world is totally messed up. That's, I think it was when I was a kid, for sure. But anyways. All right, everybody. Shabbat Shalom.
Yes,
okay, thank you very much. Okay.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.